and gentlemen, welcome back to our second section, second part of the French Connections broadcast of this Tuesday, 21st day of March, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and it's great to have you here for this part two. We've got a great interview ready to go here with my guest and researcher and imam and pilot and linguist. His name is Dr. Sahib Mastkim Blair. Now, I hope I didn't mangle his name. I'm going to bring him up right away. Was that close enough, Sahib?
Well, just keep to Sahib. It's easier, isn't it? It's Sahib Mastkim Blair, and of course, Sahib Mastkim are Arabic names I adopted when I came to Islam two and a half decades ago. And
yes.
Blair is my original German name. That's where I'm from.
Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, well, first of all, you are one of the founding members of the Islamic Party of Britain, and that being actually a grassroots organization that has over the years grown considerably. You want to talk a little bit about that organization?
Yes, we can do. I mean, it's a complex issue, of course, because the Islamic Party of Britain, we started out, that was at the height of the Rushdie affair, if some people still remember that.
Yeah.
Salman Rushdie, when he published his book, Satanic Voices, and we countered it at the time. I also have a small publishing organization, so Mustaqim, so I published a book by David Pidcock, who is the Islamic Party leader at the time, called Rushdie had Satanic Verses, and we called ours Satanic Voices, to show that this wasn't something out of the blue, but it was an orchestrated campaign in order to make the Muslims look bad and drive a rift between the population and the Muslims, just like they've done now with this cartoon row. So we demonstrated, you know, with satanic presses about the media and satanic purses about the finance system and so on. We demonstrated what lies behind it. It was at around the same time that we formed a political party, the Islamic Party of Britain, in order to have an independent voice, to put forward such issues to the electorate at time of election. We didn't ever have the hope to get elected, but it was a good time to open up debate. And interestingly, I mean, when we stood in some places, we got votes from non-Muslims, and we got certain Muslim sections who had sold out because of the funding available from local councils. We had them rejecting us. So it's been quite an interesting ride. It is difficult to, of course, run a minority party in somewhere like Britain. And it's become more difficult after 9/11, and we've more, let's say, transformed into a think tank and pressure group rather than at this moment still using the electoral process for generating debate. But in those many years of active campaigning, we've built up an interesting network of both Muslims and non-Muslims who are looking for alternative policies and who want to change the world around them, and that network has come up with very useful information ideas for...
Well, Sahib, you know, I want to ask you a question here. You know, many of the Americans, our education system has fallen into the depths of despair because they're not teaching people truth anymore. They're not teaching facts either. One of the things that people in America think is that most Arab countries are living in the Stone Age. They're barbarians. They have no culture, no education to speak of. What I would like to do right now is discuss a little bit about some Arab history and some facts. One of the things that I've always known and that many people are aware of, but many Americans may not be, is that the Arab scholars back over 2,000 years ago were responsible for mathematics being advanced, especially algebra. And not only that, they had quite a sophisticated education system that was very well developed all through the Middle Ages, while Europe was still in the Dark Ages. They were flourishing. Am I wrong?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, of course, it doesn't help us today, for example, as Muslims, to dream of the glorious past when we've kind of lost it in some way. But it is certainly true that Western civilization could not exist if it wasn't for the foundations that were built for it by Muslim Spain, by what used to be the golden age also for the Jews in that period of time, when Europe was in fact in the Dark Ages, because Spain was again a period of time, a lengthy period of time, where the interest-based finance system didn't apply, and so people could prosper. You can look at architecture, the mosque in Cordoba. You rightly pointed to mathematics, algebra in itself, algebra, an Arabic name. Likewise, astronomy. You can look at many stars and find that they have Arabic names. It's not for not without reason. The first developments of optics, the development of surgical instruments, medicine, a lot of work done in medicine. One of my favorites, one of the Arabs in 800 something, constructed and tried out the first flying machine. And when that didn't quite work the first time, he spent another 25 years perfecting it and made a better flying machine, sort of wings put together with silk and feathers and all kinds of things. And he stayed up in the air for 10 minutes. Incredible time of learning, the concept of the university, of knowledge being universal. And Europe borrowed from that and built on that, because at that time, European institutions had become repressive. They still believed in the Ptolemaic tables. They didn't accept that the earth was round. You would be burned on the stakes for postulating what essentially was the truth. What we now know as the Greek classics came to us translated to the Arabs, otherwise that would be lost to us. So this was a very fertile period in time.
I know that the Library of Alexandria is the largest library or collection of libraries in the ancient world, and one of the largest collections of books in the history of the world. Had it not been destroyed, it would have probably forwarded the Earth. It was probably the biggest disaster in the history of our planet, the burning of the Alexandria Library. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of our heritage has been lost through similar events. I mean, a lot of the history of humanity, of Mesopotamia, has been lost in the Iraq War. A lot of the artifacts have been stolen from museums there under the eyes of the occupying forces. In the Balkans, large collections in Bosnia and libraries were burned to the ground. And unfortunately, this kind of sort of hatred has no respect for what is, after all, common human heritage. Just like the Spanish achievements in Muslim Spain with the Inquisition, it was all over. It was all stamped out, and what we have left are fragments of it rather than the whole picture. It is sad that, ignorance very often wins the day. And so it's important that we pass on information and don't let a similar, age of ignorance descend upon us, because real risk.
Let's talk about who's fomenting these derisions and divisions and destructions on us all, because our research shows that it is a particular group with some very clear stated goals in mind. Certainly not all from this group are capable or interested in doing what we're going to discuss, and so I need to make that clear that not all Jews are part of this Zionist movement. But what we've been able to identify, Eric and myself and many others, is that there is a conspiracy from people in the Zionist group to foment and destroy the cohesion in the world and the goodwill between nations for their own interests and their own gains. And you want to maybe expand on that and give it a British kind of take?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'd like to go a step further. Of course, it's not always been a predominantly Jewish movement. That is certainly the case now, but it dates back through the Illuminati. It dates back to some sort of Jewish movements like the Sabbatai Levi. There are many other connections there. Essentially, the Masonic connection, and essentially what happens is that, of course, the old adage that power corrupts, and of course, people in power And particularly if they got into power not through any respect they've earned, but through manipulating people who want to stay in power. And to do so, they have to keep people enslaved and in ignorance. You know, it's the old pharaonic system as well. Pharaoh ruled by dividing people and enslaving them, and it is a pyramidal system where people hope to work themselves up to the top, but in the process get trodden upon. So it is not a Jewish invention, but it is true that this particular group of, well, I would say non-Israelite Jews, because the Hasa tribe of East European Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews, as they are commonly known, who now dominate the Zionist and Israeli agenda, and who discriminate against Sephardic Jews, who are the Oriental or Arab Jews, the original Israelites. Those Khazar or Ashkenazi Jews are not actually, Köstler called them the 13th tribe, and there are only 12 tribes of Israel. So they were people who adopted Judaism out of political convenience and then took it over from within, and once they had achieved that, moved on to take over other societies. They settled in Amsterdam as banking families, which of course was a niche for the Jews due to the prohibition of interest for the Christians. From there they moved with the so-called glorious revolution with Oliver Cromwell. They moved to Britain, dethroned the king and put their own man in place, William of Orange, and with that the whole British colonialism, the Irish suppression, the Scottish suppression, all that started with those Amsterdam families moving to Britain. And they have had that influence ever since, through not so much religious fervor, but through financial manipulation, through financing wars on both sides, Napoleon and Wellington, the Rothschild family, and the Rothschild family is still the leading banking dynasty, made loads of money by backing both sides in that war, and they still keep doing that, and they destroy kingdoms and independence, and that is the whole idea, because you don't want anybody to be independent if you want to enslave them and be their master.
Well, you know, I've looked into James Gibbs Stewart's work, of course, about, you know, the formation of the banking structure and how it's been used to bully nations and to beat them over the head with blunt financial instruments to control them. But, you know, here we are right now in a situation where these people are also connecting themselves to some of these Talmudic traditions as well. And they're using the Jewish community and its demands or desire to have a messianic future for themselves to actually manipulate them into acting in their in their name. In other words, this banking group is usurping this religion, Judaism, using these Talmudic traditions and actually fomenting and fomenting all kinds of horrors around the world.
Well, you know, what a lot of people don't understand is that there is two types of Judaism, you know. If you go to a synagogue, you never know whom somebody prays to, because there is Judaism that follows the Torah, which is the law given to Moses, and there is Judaism which follows the Talmud, which, of course, is the exact opposite, which is a form of almost, you could say devil worship. The Talmud was adopted by the Jews in the Babylonian exile, and it is the old paganism coming back. It is witchcraft, it is magic. It has very little to do, or nothing to do really, with the Torah.
Now, which one does the Ashkenazis put forward?
Well, the Talmud has become their central book. It's more important than the Torah for them, unfortunately. But it is in total violation, those rabbinical teachings, the same rabbinical teachings that Jesus was so vehemently against when he threw the money changers out of the temple. Those rabbinical teachings are more important to them today than the Holy Scripture itself. And that is where religion can be perverted. And I mean, that any religion is at risk of that, that you abandon the scripture and actually follow the teachings of some interpreters of the scripture who twist it around for you. Because for those who wish power, I mean, religion is a very nice tool to control people. If you can tell them that they fight that war because their religion tells them so, if you can tell them that they must obey, let's say, the state because it's the pious thing to do, and people in their heart have a faith, then they easily misled in that way. And of course, they have tweaked onto that, and they use that very, very effectively. So the Talmudic Judaism is very different from the Torah Judaism. And it's important to differentiate that. Orthodox Jews who believe in the Torah, they do not agree with the foundation of the State of Israel to start with, because it's an abomination, because until the Messiah returns, they're not allowed to have a state. They're meant to be in a diaspora. So everything we see that is sold to us as Jewish ideals is actually an affront to real Judaism.
Well, you know, but there are some things within the Bible that are rather disturbing, even for the true Torah Jews. I mean, we've got stuff in Deuteronomy that is pretty frightening, as well as some other things.
Of course, there is also the problem, and that is what you have with the Bible. And I don't want to preach Islam here now to your listeners, because the Quran has overcome some of these problems by reestablishing some of these truths. The Bible is available to us in translation. It has changed hands through translation many times, and things get lost and things get added, and it is sometimes difficult to separate, even within the biblical text, what is the original revelation and what is commentary by those to whom it was entrusted. And some of these things, from my perspective, would be later additions. Because, for example, I give you one example, you have this prohibition of interest in the Bible that says that you shall not lend upon interest to your brother. But then comes, and I don't remember the exact wording, but then comes immediately another sentence that kind of tells, but to the stranger it's all right, you know, just not to your brother. And that is not really the real spirit, but looks like a later addition that it says, well, amongst ourselves we stick by the law, but to the other people, the goyim, the people who are not under our law, we'll exploit them. That is not divinely ordained. That is a later human addition of
now,
the advantage
this,
of people.
What is your take on the Amalek and the Goyim position that most Gentiles find themselves in, all of Gentiles, in the eyes of these Talmudic believers? Because this is important, because many Talmudically taught children grow up with this ideal that they are somehow ordained as superior, and that the people that they live around and amongst are equal to cattle.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of this sort of what you had in America at the time of like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. You know, you had little black children dreaming of blue-eyed Jesus. Bearing in mind that, of course, Aramaic as he was, he wouldn't have been, but that people create icons in their own image. You know, God isn't racist because he created them all. So this idea of a superior race that you find kind of in today's Jewish identification really is anathema to anybody who has any idea of real belief. But it is being practiced because it helps the people who spread that myth. There isn't such a thing as there are. Well, chosen people, the Israelites as the chosen people, is a different story. They were chosen to follow the law, and they're lost. You find many references in the Bible that condemn them strongly, because when they abandoned the way that was chosen for them, they also lost that special favor. So, for a true believer, the favor that you get from God is actually related to your actions, to your deeds, to your integrity. And if you lose that integrity, you lose that protection. You can't.
Well, what they've done is the Talmudic tradition is saying that God
has, who they are. Yes.
Well, God's right hand acts in a righteous way, and his left hand acts in a non-righteous way. But they're both God's actions, according to this Talmudic tradition.
Yes, well, I mean, the Talmud, as I said, brings the old dualism back. It brings the old pharaonic system back. I mean, why do you think they worship pyramids and Cleopatra's needles and obelisks and things like that? It's nothing to do with the monotheistic tradition that they claim to follow. It's all to do with the cult that they picked up in Babylon and that they continue to follow. And a lot of people don't realize how, even so, our societies today claim to be secular. They actually follow some kind of Satanist religion. A lot of people don't notice that. I mean, why do we have all these cults? Why do we put an obelisk everywhere we build a new town center or something? Why are these symbolisms so strong? Because behind the scenes, away from the understanding of ordinary citizens, they actually follow their own pseudo-religious cult, and it's not a good one. It's not a nice one, really, when you look deeper into it.
Well, it's a frightening one, and in fact, it's what we've been discovering here on this. On this broadcast, is that their plans for us are anything but positive, and in some cases we are to be done away with if you follow some of their writings, you know. And what we found here is a link between this belief system, the money system coming through Rothschild and Schief and Warburg and many others like them, and then the marriage of the political systems in Britain, France, America, Canada, even Germany now, if you take a look at Merkel's actions. And what one wonders here is what are their goals in your view, and how have they been able to so clearly usurp the constitutions and the interests of these populations in all these countries? It's astonishing to an outsider, but once you've looked beneath the surface, it's quite clear that's what's going on.
It's astonishing because it happens not in our public view. We don't pay attention to it. We're so distracted. We've got so much to do. We've got a mortgage to pay, a living to make, taxes to pay. People just don't have time to look beyond their own immediate problems. And this is part of the design. I mean, we are kind of being taught or even brainwashed that we live in a very enlightened age and that everything is so liberal and so... just like in the old days, all the royal families were interconnected. Still here in Britain, we have a family that is originally German running the British throne. And, you know, these modern dynasties are no different. There is a long pedigree from George Bush all the way to Walker Prescott Bush, all the way through the families. I mean, the Nazi Party who was financed by them, the Warburgs in Germany at the time. You can see them all being interlinked, the Rothschild connection, the Rockefeller connection. It's all there, and they run similar like dynasties, but under a democratic mantle. Democracy is a little bit like you get the same parties or different parties running the same policies. It's like a shift change, but the management stays the same. And what you find is that, of course, these dynasties of families have specialized on statecraft for several hundred years. And so naturally, they know all the tricks of the trade. They know how to do it. They're good at it. And if somebody starts meddling in it, it's going to take them a long time to find out what's really going on, because they've pursued it while other people were busy with other things. And,
well, you know,
and
what
this is
we've
what
been
escapes people's notice, that there is an ongoing, long-term planning. Things don't just happen by accident. Okay, some people figured out there's like Bilderbergers and this and that there are some meetings of important business and politicians, business people, and people in of influence in the world, and they get an inkling that there is something happening. But what they often don't realize is that this has been going on over centuries, and that there are people who run the world. The world doesn't run itself. There are people who run the world and don't really want to be discovered, because it's much better to do so shielded and out of public view than to having to explain yourself.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know, one of the things I want to bring up here, and maybe you can get your take on this, the New Bohemians, when they arrived in America back in the 1780s, they were sent by the Frankist movement to start Masonic lodges. Now, we've found a name that cropped up was a Solomon Bush, and another one was a George Bush. And they were both sent over as New Bohemians from the German side of the ledger. But it was German Judaism and German Frankists that sent them over to start these Masonic lodges. Do you have any information on that?
I don't have an awful lot on that particular aspect, but yes, the Masonic lodges and they also come of the German Illuminati. The lodges were created as how should I put this? It's a form of interface. You see, if you are a small group of people, it's very difficult to control everybody and everything all the time. You need some sort of interface. You need a group of other people who do that for you, but you can, as it were, direct their leaders. So the idea was that amongst the uninitiated, or the Goyim, or the Gentiles, or whatever you want to call them, you let them have their own hierarchical structures, and but only at the top level do they realize whom they actually employed by, whom they working for, and and you make it attractive for them because you give them incentives, you give them mutual help promises, and they look after each other, they put each other out of distress, they give each other jobs, and so on and so forth. So it is a setup that allows a small group to control a larger society through agents taken from that larger society. And of course, it was an instrument very similar to let's say, rule by proxy in the colonies. When it became unsustainable and also uncomfortable, for example, for the empires, France or Britain or Holland, to actually rule their various colonies, which they wanted to rule because of their resources, directly through their own people, they decided it was much easier to give them semi-independence, to give them the semblance of that they run their own affairs, but make sure that they divided them into different sects and factions, and always put the minority faction in charge, and that minority faction would then need to have the help from the outside to protect themselves against the majority belonging. So they would always be loyal servants of the outside masters. So you have, for example, in Syria, which is a predominantly Sunni population, if we come back to the Arab world, what a lot of people talk about nowadays, you would have a minority Shiite government. You would have in Iraq, which is a Shia population, you would have had a minority Sunni government that always needed the military and logistical and so on support from their French or British or later on in the day American paymasters. And, and that way, you rule by proxy. And the Masonic setup is a very similar one in the early days, where they created those lodges, and through those lodges began influencing the chambers of commerce and the guilds for various professions, and the legal profession, and the banking fraternity, and so on and so forth. And bright people like Abraham Lincoln, for example, they did recognize and realize that, and ultimately paid with their lives. because he quite clearly stated that he found the bankers a bigger threat to him than the opposing armies. You know, so some people did point it out, but they managed to keep the subterfuge going long enough to put themselves into positions from which they could not easily be unseated. And once they had created, like Bretton Woods, the central bank, etc., well, it was plain sailing since then, because once they control the money system, the finance of a country, what choice did people have? And it's the same today. Most people haven't realized how fictitious and fraudulent the money system is, but even if they do realize, and a lot of people don't want to accept it because they can't accept that they've been lied to, but even if they did realize, what they're going to do, there are enough trappings that keep them going because they don't want to lose it all.
Well, I got to tell you, there's a simple thing, Sahib. We could take over for ourselves and declare all debts public and private, null and void.
Yes, that is a nice idea, but you can only do it from a position where actually whatever you say is taken by other people as being authoritative. Otherwise, you can declare anything, but what difference does it make to people's lives if they still depend on a paycheck from their employer and they still have the debt collector knocking on their door if they don't make their payments? So it's not as simple as just putting the information across. It's very important to bridge the information gap, because if people aren't informed, they can't do anything. If they haven't got the necessary background information, they don't understand what's going on. If you don't know your enemy, you can't fight it. But after that, there is a lot more to be done, because you have to kind of wrestle that power back from the people who've usurped it. And they don't go willingly, they don't go easily, even though I always believe they have a great potential to self-destruct, but even then they try to take all of us down with them. So you have to kind of develop parallel alternative structures. Some people have tried it with local exchange trading systems, for example, where they're not so dependent on the main currency by trading amongst each other through other ways of measuring and calculating the value of their services and goods. But it's a difficult and uphill task because you have an established system that, yes, you can show how the emperor has no clothes, but he's still in charge. He's still got a lot of people who also know he has no clothes but don't want to admit it because they are in his pay.
Well, here's the interesting thing that they made a mistake on, and I brought this up on this program before. Two mistakes, actually. Many of the plans that they've played out over the last few years here were hatched back in the 1970s under Kissinger and friends. And of course, during that time, the Internet was not envisioned as a tool for the masses. And the second thing was, and what happened with that Internet is that it has done a morph against what they had. They were not able to control it. It became something bigger than they.
But they were resisted, indeed.
Right. The second thing is that they thought a puppet like George Walker Bush would be an easy man to control. But what they didn't realize is that he is so stupid that he would actually turn around and hurt them. And George Bush has been responsible for bringing more people to the truth in the United States than any single force anywhere. We have to be grateful to this man because he is stupid in the extreme. And as a result, he has done terrible damage to their cause.
Well, there's been a lot of own goals, not just this. I mean, with their overconfidence over the Iraq war, you know, being greeted with flowers, they thought, with their wrong assessment of their own strengths, these neocons that nobody really knew about other than people who had studied the matter, they came out of the closet, they showed their colors. And of course, that is coming back to haunt them. It's the old arrogance comes before the fall. And they are now, of course, running out of time because more and more people realize what is being played. How it's playing out, I don't know, because I wouldn't put it beyond them that they quite happily like to go for some limited nuclear showdown with Iran or something like that just to move the agenda on. And one has to be careful, because they have no scruples. There is certainly, the anti-war protests were the strongest protests, even so the media were strongly in the pro-Iraq camp, the strongest protest we had ever seen since the 1960s, since the Vietnam protests. And a lot has changed since then. There isn't the direct action potential anymore, and the mm-hmm. trade unions have been dismantled and don't exist anymore, really, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And the Labour Party here has become more right-wing than the original right-wing Tory Party, and a lot's been turned on its head. But nonetheless, people are waking up, and people want a voice, and people demonstrate that they want a voice, and the internet has helped them, if they want to look for information, to get that information. So certainly there is a lot going on, and some hope. And of course, whichever way it goes, the better option in my view is if people manage to wrestle power back from those who have usurped it and save us a lot of damage in the process. But if they don't manage, I think the days of... I always look at it from the distant view of dynasties or empires. You know, they have an ascendancy, they rise, and then they become decadent, and then they decline, and then they disappear. Whether that's the Romans or the Greeks or the old Persians or wherever you look in history, it's like the normal curve in life. That things go through, and of course the sort of European American dynasty or empire will have a similar pattern, and I have no doubt that there are, and you can see it with little things that happen, little trade disputes, and that there are lots waiting on the sidelines to move in the moment the big bully shows some weakness. There is a lot happening in South America. There's a lot happening in China. There is a lot happening with many of the economies.
Yeah, but Sahib, when you look behind
Western economies now,
when you look behind these areas, though, you still see. And I'll give you an example: the first bank that's been permitted to represent Chinese people from outside of China is the Rothschild Bank. In other words, these people are already getting ensconced in China. They're already involved in South America. They don't care if America falls.
They know as well as we do that they have to shift to new territories if they want to keep in charge. And they're trying to build their empires there, too. But there is an opportunity, I think, if one realizes that, to maybe thwart that for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm hoping that that's the case. I'd like to talk now a little bit about this 7/7 event. As I told you in our private conversation, I was in Britain just days after that attack, and I was one of the first people to go on television and say that the 7/7 attack was clearly an inside job, and that the Muslim community of Britain had nothing more than a patsy position in that whole plan, and that they were being victimized and vilified by the people in charge. And we know that today that is the story. That was what happened. Do you have anything to add to what went on in that, and what kind of facts maybe are not well known that you could share?
Yeah, well, when one looks at events like this, there is the typical pattern of cover-up that makes you suspicious. There are certain pieces of information that are carefully released at certain times. 7/7, we have the follow-up attacks, the copycat attacks, on the 21st of July. And all the arrests, all the prosecutions, everything that ever took place focuses on that 21st of July. Nothing focuses on 7-7. Nobody investigates that. It's a close and shut case where they say, well, these guys blew themselves up. They're dead. We can blame them. We don't have to try them. It's as simple as that. There are, of course, a lot of inconsistencies. The damage that was caused to the train, as if it was if there was a bomb planted underneath it rather than on it. You know, if you're a suicide bomber, why do you buy a return ticket on the train?
Why would they direct Tavistock Square's bus into a small alleyway next to a demolition van?
And why explode it on the top of the bus rather than, you know? And why do the cameras suddenly fail? Everywhere where you needed the cameras fail. I mean, it's not like there is one camera per square mile. London's full of cameras that can allegedly pick up number plates and figure out whether you paid your road tax. There are cameras everywhere, but there are no cameras that picked up anything in London related to 7-7. Nothing's been released. There is a still picture from outside London where they allegedly boarded a train. Well, anybody can board a train. It proves nothing. You know, you can hire people, you can pay them some money and say, deliver this for me. And they will be stupid enough to do it if the price is high enough, and they won't ask because they probably think it's drugs or something. There's lots of things you can do. It proves nothing. One of the best questions to ask is always who benefits, and immediately we have to rush to new legislation, identity cards, as if suicide bombers would be worried about identity cards. These guys all have their identity cards, or their identification. They weren't hiding it.
In fact, they piled them up neatly on the side of their
as
seat.
One does, yes.
Yes.
A bit like the passport in 9/11.
It floated down pristine.
Yes, that fire that melts steel and concrete, but leaves passports intact.
So
we had that rush to new anti-terror legislation, controlling what people may or may not say, more powers for the police to arrest now not only with suspicion of a crime, but arrest anyway, even if there's no suspicion of a crime, powers to the police to call curfews. And what people don't realize is because they're willing to give up the liberty because they feel there's a threat of terrorism and from the Muslims, and so most of us aren't Muslims, so that's all right. And if you haven't done anything wrong, you've got nothing to fear. And that's a lot of humbug, really, because these laws are not intended to be used against those minorities. These are used against the majority population when they start feeling that something is wrong and start speaking out against it, because the standard of living that people have been bought off with in European countries is inevitably going to decline. It can't be sustained at those levels. We live on borrowed time and borrowed money, and when it declines, there is going to be dissatisfaction, protests, etc., and these powers are then required to keep populations in check and to keep check on their movements and to know what they're up to and where they're going and whom they're meeting and all that.
Well, that's exactly what they've done with this, and you're exactly on the money with that, and it's our assessment is identical to yours. I want to move on to one other subject here, and it's about free speech. It's about keeping people quiet from speaking out on the power structure, and it has to do with an individual who recently got a great deal of press in the alternative news, even on the mainstream news, for committing himself to an engagement in a country where he knew he'd be arrested when he arrived there. A lot of suspicions here, and of course, we at the French Connection were aware from the beginning that this particular gentleman had a lot of questions that needed to be answered, many that we still, to this day, find unacceptable. His name is David Irving, and Mr. Irving clearly, in our view, is a plant of this group. Why? Again, who benefits? Again, who's the person who's best going to receive, a policy shift or a belief shift in their favor? And certainly, it was in the protection of this Holocaust discussion thing, which I can't really talk about because I'm in France, but I do want to discuss it as a way of shutting down free speech and instilling fear in people. It seems like there were so many anomalies in this particular event that it kind of exposes this guy for as a shill, in my view.
I wouldn't probably agree with all that. Irving had his own trial before, his libel trial in London, and made an utter mess of it. He conducted it himself and conducted it poorly. It was under a very high publicity. He lost his case. He did not attempt to demolish any of the evidence put forward by the other side. Almost as if the whole thing was set up in order to say, well, this idea of revisionism is being tried and tested in court and found to be wanting, and end of discussion.
Yep.
In a way, this is often what happens if you can't avoid a certain suspicion anymore. We have a similar thing here with sort of, Princess Diana and all the rumors and conspiracy theories, as they call them. And nobody tell me that conspiracies don't happen, because you can get arrested in a court for conspiring with somebody to defraud or to rob a bank. This is what called conspiracies, and they do happen. Now you look at these things, and because people talk and it's not going away. Initially, you deny, you don't mention it, you keep it quiet. But when that doesn't work anymore, then you have a pretended debate. You say, some people say this, but that's rubbish, and some people say that, but yeah, we throw this out, and that's lunacy as well. And you ridicule it. When that doesn't work either, then you need to, like we now have about Diana, you need to then put in a sort of committee or commission, like it was 9/11. You had a committee looking at the facts and ignoring most of the facts, really. But it gives the semblance as if there was a proper investigation, preferably an independent one. And the Irving thing is a similar thing. You pick somebody who represents the other side poorly and demolish him, and hoping to demolish the whole argument. We see it with, as myself as Muslim, we see it in the Muslim community all the time, when there is a public, when on the television or the radio they pick up a Muslim, they always use somebody who can't articulate, who is very emotional, who makes outrageous statements. And then they say, look, this is what these Muslims are saying, and then they go full force against it. Whereas they don't pick somebody who represents the kind of quite different mainstream opinion of Muslims in the country. So this is one of the methods of trying to, and we shouldn't be too disheartened about it, because what it indicates is that the argument is growing, that it's growing stronger, that people are asking questions. That you now have to frighten them with the law as well, and say, if you ask these questions too loudly, we will arrest you. But that doesn't make things go away. It indicates that they have realized that they can no longer just pretend that everything, the propaganda is working. But there are holes everywhere. It's seeping through everywhere. There is a lot of damage limitation they have to do. So in some sense, this is a good sign. I mean, I always go by the German philosopher Fichte, who said, and I paraphrase here, and I really like this analysis. He said the truth is like light in the fight against darkness. The moment it is out in the open, darkness or falsehood has already lost. Because if you put a little light on, the darkness has to go away. So you want an open showdown. Once it's out in the open, it's a completely different ball game. They can only keep the lid on things if they carry on doing it behind scenes. But once the information, that's why information is so essential. Once it gets out there, and it gets out there not just to a few people who are on the in, but actually to the greater public. It goes out to all and sundry. And people may not understand it fully, but they at least get a little bit of an idea what's happening, what's going on, and this doesn't add up. Something's wrong here. Once that happens, then gradually they lose. I mean, it's a little bit like in repressive countries like the Soviet Union at the time. You get the political jokes. You get people quietly saying things carefully because they don't want to be picked up. You get dissent, dissident voices. And I think the same is happening to this kind of Western liberalism that we've been preached all along, and kind of the color, the makeup is peeling off, and we see behind the facade what is really there. So I'm confident in that respect that certainly something has changed.
Well, I'd like to share with you again, and I already did this privately, my idea for bringing the youth into this fight with us. I talked to you about MySpace, and I told you that my goal here with MySpace was to start bridging the gap between my age group, your age group. Probably we're not far apart, I would imagine. I'm about 50 years old, and
I'm a little bit behind, but not far.
Okay, well, I'm actually 49, so if you want to be real accurate, I'm almost 50. But here's the thing. I mean, we've got a group of young people who have been estranged from the generation above them by design. They don't speak very often to people in our age group. Why? Because our culture has decided that that's how they're going to control us. What we're interested in doing is beginning to share these facts with young university-age students. And we decided that the place to do it is where they congregate. And they congregate at this place called MySpace. So we opened up a site, and we've got about 35-40% of our membership are people in our age group, knowledgeable for the most part in many of these facts. And we're beginning to mentor people below, and we're going to try to bring them up to speed on some of the facts that are available so that they can vet it themselves and they can become knowledgeable about these things so the next generation does not have to begin this work over again. And I think this is probably a very good idea, and I'm wondering what you think about it.
It's a very good idea in the sense that, you know, of course, if you break the flow of information from one generation to another, then you lose that whole wealth of it. Because it takes a lifetime to find out about something. If you can't pass on what you've learned, then you have a problem in that the next generation has to do it all again for themselves. And obviously, that is such an utter waste of time. But what I would want to say is that, because I mentioned earlier that the people who run the show, they've specialized on it for hundreds of years. They're passing it down one generation to the other. And they don't want us to catch up. But what I would want to say is that, of course, when it comes to young people, mentoring is really important. But we have a very theoretically biased education system now, where people spend until their mid-20s just learning from books and filling their head, but they can't apply anything. And very different from the old apprenticeship where you learned on the job. And in a way, young people are very frustrated about that because what youth has, it doesn't have the wisdom and the knowledge, but it has the energy. So under good direction, the young people want to get out and do things and make a difference. And whether it's going on demonstrations or picketing certain places or writing letters or protesting for the release of somebody or whatever. So I think it's very important that it's not just mentoring with information, but actually that we can try to guide them to action that they can successfully do and where they also can learn and gain confidence from those successes. Because
yes.
We learn through gradually being coached into confidence and where we can also make mistakes but learn from them too. It's very important that sort of environment is being set up because this is where I feel we're lacking the most at the moment. I meet a lot of young people through the Islamic Party, for example, who come along and say, well, be really excited about this, what you found out there, and it makes sense, and what can we do to help? And the trouble is there isn't often much you can give them to do. Other than saying, well, study it further, pass it on, tell other people, but that's not what they're looking for. Young people want to actually get actively, you know, get involved, get their hands, you know, really pull up their sleeves and do something together. And so, of course, you can't necessarily do that on the internet. So the idea, in my view, is that if such a MySpace as you have on the internet, and if that can then translate into maybe local resource and action centers, you know, places where people actually can physically congregate, like an internet cafe that has sort of the right leanings or whatever, where they can meet, where they can discuss in person, where they can actually plan, you know, make posters or plan actions or do things that they feel they can express whatever they found, whatever.
Well, you know, these seeds, Doctor, are starting now. We've only begun this a week ago, and in fact, already we are finding that it is going to be a hard slog, but it's also going to be rewarding. We're starting to see certain rewards already. I got to be honest with you. I don't know how much time we have here. Of course, these people don't sit idly by as we make our plans.
I think this is the way to go because if we can translate this into physical groups on the ground, then even if they eventually start controlling the internet, you know, because that might well come with the same sort of, you know, Warner Brothers and the lot having their tap on it, AOL, and you get it over your TV and it gets heavily filtered. But even if that happens, it's then too late to put the clock back because these people then no longer rely just on knowing each other through the net, but they know each other personally. I think there is a lot to be said for kind of regenerating community because we've all been parceled off. For the state, if it wants to be dominant, it's best for them if they have just individuals, all dependent on the state. Nobody has family they can rely on. Nobody has friends they can rely on. Everybody's on their own. This is their ideal, isn't it? We must reverse that trend somehow and recreate communities, real communities.
That's right.
Because
that's
different from now in the 60s you've mentioned, because then people met in the street. People talked to each other, and information filtered down that way.
Yes,
and then they did things together.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's,
you know,
what's happening these days, and I think we need to bring that back somehow.
Well, we're going to try, and you know what I've got to say to finish up our discussion today because we've used up pretty much all of our time. I want to tell you that this battle that we have beginning here is only the start because most people are aware that this is a huge subject with many, many different facets to it, and unless we're able to understand it fully, and this includes the young people and people of our age, what we're going to be doing, instead of making differences, we're going to be descending in acrimony because one person believes that this is true and one. So we're in the process right now of solidifying a rational analysis of the entire thing so that people don't have to sit and fight about what's real and what isn't.
Yeah, I know
this has been the problem.
Running out of time, I want to just say one thing there as well, which I believe is very important, is that we do display a great deal of tolerance towards each other. So if somebody's only halfway with us, you don't denounce them, put them off, because that often happens with movements and with people, you know. Oh, yeah, he's only half-hearted there, or he doesn't understand this, and you start losing people rather than having people join. It doesn't matter how far people want to walk with you, as long as they walk some way, and then they carry on their own. And I think that's important, that we also, from the start, kind of, have this tolerant attitude built in whatever we're going to do.
Well, I half agree with that. Now, I got to tell you, there are a lot of people out there who are supposed to be representing the investigation side of this who will only go a short distance. And why? Because we believe they're part of the conspiracy and not part of the solution. And we don't have tolerance for their inability to take part, because what we do, Eric and I understand, yes, is that they're only telling half the truth by design.
I see what you're saying. I meant more like people, you know, it's very hard for some people when, you know, when they believe in the smoke screens and mirrors all the time.
Yeah.
And suddenly you take the blinkers off their eyes and they're all dazzled. And I think, hey, how is this possible? It's very hard for them to adjust to that. And it's sometimes a slow and painful process.
Yeah.
And you must give people time to do that. Because,
I agree.
You know, you can't throw them in the water and say, go and swim. I mean, some manage, but a lot of them will drown.
That's how I learned to swim.
But a lot of people, you know, they need to kind of test the water, put their toe in first and say, well, yeah, okay, I didn't get hurt. Maybe I'll try. And we have to scaffold them in that way to help them break away from that false sense of security that this fake society that they live in provides for them. They're only with it because it provides them with that kind of false sense of security. And it's very easy. I found that when you spend a lot of time with people who share your views, to forget how frightening and strange these views can appear to people elsewhere, and
yeah,
how you sort of very carefully don't give them an overdose, but put them on a very gentle course of remedies, you know. And we forget that sometimes, and then of course it becomes a fringe movement. And I think we are in need of a wide base.
Yes.
This is what I meant by what I was saying. Of course, there are always detractors, and there are people who pretend for the purpose of trying to lead people elsewhere, and one has to be very, very alert about that.
Well, you know, Dr. Sahib Mustaqim Blair, my guest today, you are certainly a very learned man and a very inspiring guest. I hope that what I can do for the future is request maybe in a private call that you do an investigation for me on a subject that you're well acquainted with, and we can bring you back for another installment that we would do something a little different than this particular discussion, where we went a lot of places, and we would do something a little bit more educational in a particular subject, if you'll acquiesce to that request.
It's been a real pleasure being your guest today, so I'm sure we can continue working together on other issues, and yeah, I look forward to that.
Mail, me too. And I got to tell you, this fight is just getting heated up, and I relish the battle, because you know something, there's something very noble and very righteous about fixing something that's so terribly broken, Doctor. And I got to tell you, I don't shrink from the challenge. Instead, I want to rise up to it. And so many people are doing it with me that it's definitely an exciting time. And like the Chinese proverb says, you know, may you live in exciting times.
Yes, well, indeed. I mean, we all start out as idealists, and it's nice to sometimes meet people who revive some of that idealism for you as well, you know, because on the way, it's very easy to shed that because of the way things are going, sometimes from bad to worse. But
yeah,
one mustn't forget that light at the end of the tunnel, and really keep going for it.
Well, I've got to tell you, thank you so much for coming on the French Connection today, and I look forward to speaking to you privately as well as on another installment. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Sahib Mustaqim Blair from Great Britain, a German by origin and a Brit by transplant, one of the founders of the Islamic Party in Britain, and an extremely well-educated interviewee on the subjects that we at the French Connection treat every day. And I want to thank him and all his efforts that he made. And until the next installment of the French Connection, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying be well and tune in for more French Connection in the future. Bye-bye.